It's up to everybody to not focus in on one single voice, but to do a medley of all of the points of view, because no one of them is correct. Every media has its own specific bias.
I think that some newspapers, and I won't call names, I think they tend to write from a certain angle. And during election time, for me, it's apparent that some papers are supporting certain candidates. So they tend to write in favor of one candidate and against another.
They had to have an educated citizenry or the whole venture, and they saw it as an adventure, as a challenge, would fail. The experiment would fail.
Brown University historian Gordon Wood is author of Empire of Liberty and winner of the Pulitzer Prize. He's an expert on the early American Republic.
Nothing on this scale, Democratic government or Republican government, had ever been tried since the fall of Rome. So they know they're doing something very new, very tricky, very problematic. Can we make it succeed? That's what, of course, runs right through American history. That's what Lincoln is talking about 70 years later. We have the last best hope. Can we make it? Can democracy make it? That's an issue that they think about, and they have confidence, but they need an educated citizenry.
In the 1770s, the decade of ferment that gave birth to the United States, American colonists became agitated by what they saw as unfair tax policies and trade restrictions, as well as harassment by the British crown. As the revolutionaries' movement gained momentum, activists in the 13 East Coast colonies strengthened their lines of communication.
Up and down the seaboard, there was an effort through newspapers and pamphlets to engage the citizenry, to inform them about their political rights, and they believed that if the population was well informed about their political rights, then British measures at tyranny would be stymied.
Richard Brown, University of Connecticut historian and author of The Strength of a People.
Their ideology that came out of opposition politics in Britain told them that if a people was ignorant, sleepy, lazy, they were easily manipulated by demagogues and tyrants.
But cultivation of an informed citizenry was viewed by the revolutionaries as more than a political necessity. When America's founders sounded the Liberty Bell at Philadelphia to let freedom ring, they were proclaiming a new view of human rights, even if that view was constrained by 18th century mores. For Virginia's Thomas Jefferson, author of the Declaration of Independence, it was the starting point for an entirely different kind of society.
Well, the vision would be that when human beings are educated, that they live their lives by reason. He was a person who believed that reason should be, as he said, in its seat, and progress would unfold from there.
Historian and law professor Annette Gordon Reed, winner of the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award for her book The Hemingses of Monticello, is a Jefferson scholar.
So this idea of the diffusion of knowledge throughout the citizenry was a way of ensuring that the values of the Enlightenment, of which he would have thought of himself as an Enlightenment progressive type, would spread across the country and would spread across the land. And he almost saw it as an inevitable thing, that if educated people would make the right choices. Now, that was a part of his own sort of personal optimism. And, of course, there were people who felt differently, who had a more, they would say, realistic view of human nature, saying that that's not going to be enough, that, in fact, you have to have an elite or elites in order to make decisions, that they will be the people who will always rule. That was much more of a Hamiltonian vision, that there would always be an elite who would control. I think Jefferson and others took a more capacious view of what democracy should be, that in fact, the more people who were involved, more people who were educated, more people who were knowledgeable, that it would fuel the general sense of progress in the world, and you wouldn't have to rely upon elites to do that. But I think all of them understood there had to be citizen involvement. With no monarchy, the people had to be sovereign.
Listening to An Informed Republic, a special from Humankind. I'm David Freudberg. For more information on this segment, please visit our website, humanmedia.org. Today's high-speed printing technology would probably have blown the mind even of the inventive Benjamin Franklin. He operated a hand-cranked press at his print shop in Philadelphia, where Poor Richard's Almanac was published starting in 1732. Early America relied on the printed word as the foremost medium of information, and a high degree of literacy pervaded the United States from its inception. Historian Gordon Wood.
Close to 90% in New England, males, women less, but maybe 70%. But there's probably no place in the world, with the possible exception from what study has been made, of parts of Scandinavia where you had such high literacy. And of course, by the early decades of the 19th century, we had become the greatest newspaper reading public in the world. I mean, more papers read here than, not per capita, but just in total numbers of newspapers than anywhere else in the world.
Early American readers learned legal, political, and commercial information from their newspapers, frequently published by small-town printers. And once the final state, Rhode Island, ratified the Constitution, America's founders realized that newspapers, often transported by horseback riders, would play a vital role in preservation of the emerging country. Richard Brown.
They understand that they have a vast territory in 1790, that in order to create a nation, there must be a community of citizenship, a community of information. And if there is to be such a community of information, there must be national networks that will enable this community of information to be created and to continue to operate. There was a postal system, of course, operating under the British, and indeed Benjamin Franklin was a postmaster for the American colonies. And it was always seen from the beginning that having a post office was a key function of a national government.
For the purpose of diffusing knowledge, as well as extending the living principles of government to every part of the United States.
Benjamin Rush, physician, Philadelphia Quaker, and signer of the Declaration of Independence.
Every state, city, county, village, and township in the Union should be tied together by means of the post office. This is the true non-electric wire of government. It should be a constant injunction to the postmasters to convey newspapers free of all charge for postage.
They encourage newspaper editors to exchange newspapers freely with each other, and newspapermen could send their newspaper to other newspapers free. So there's this grand, you might call it an internet of newspapers, moving information freely through the postal system. And the idea was that the newspapers should be a mechanism whereby people should be informed about public affairs. Local affairs, state affairs, national affairs, international affairs. They wanted people to not be parochial, located only in their own little community, but to raise their consciousness to a broader appreciation of public affairs.
Were it left to me to decide whether we should have a government without newspapers, or newspapers without a government, I should not hesitate a moment to prefer the latter. Thomas Jefferson.
When you look at the colonial period and how few, relatively few newspapers, relatively few magazines existed, and then look at what happened after 1776, an extraordinary transformation.
Historian Gordon Wood.
Magazines exploded, newspapers exploded, and then lecture series, the whole paraphernalia of civil society emerges. Libraries, public libraries in various towns, particularly in New England. Now, the North remains, really advances rather rapidly. The South remains more static, and by 1820, the South has many fewer newspapers, fewer libraries, fewer of all of these instruments in the South. The South remains much more rural, much more stuck in the 18th century. And so the differences in the two sections begin to emerge, I think, rather quickly.
The founders of the United States were keenly aware that democracy always comes with risks. For the system to work, for voters to make wise choices, the citizenry must make the effort to be knowledgeable. Said American revolutionary Thomas Paine, those who expect to reap the blessings of freedom must undergo the fatigue of supporting it.
People can be fooled if you don't know how the government works, if you don't know your own powers as a citizen, what you have a right to demand, what you have a right to expect from your leaders.
Historian and New York Law School professor Annette Gordon Reed.
You have to know how it works. And it's not a terribly complicated process. You know, strangely enough, it's not a wildly, you know, convoluted system we have here. But I think the real thing is that you can't make the government work for you. You can't play your role in the government if you don't understand how these things work. And it's really frightening to think that people don't understand, you know, the rights, the Bill of Rights, don't understand the Constitution, don't understand the procedures that make the government run. And it's all about, that's how you preserve freedom. You have to be knowledgeable in order to do that.
If you think of authoritarian governments, they hold the society together from the top down. But a republic or a democracy has to be held together from the bottom up. And so you need people who are educated, who are willing to support the society, are willing to give up their selfish interests for the sake of the public good. And these people need to be educated.
Jefferson's commitment to education was really at the core of his life.
Charles Haynes, senior scholar at the First Amendment Center in Washington, has studied the American revolutionaries.
They were part of this influence of the Enlightenment that said, you know, learning and education really can lead to progress, lead to truth. And they had a deep commitment to that.
Many of America's founders were interested in great works of philosophy and history and emphasized the teaching of the classics as part of a well-rounded education for citizens.
Greek and Latin, for example, would be at the core of learning. And of course, that really goes back to being able to read the Bible in those early languages. But then it also speaks to their interest in the great classics and reading Plato and Cicero and so forth. They believe those writers, Aristotle, were necessary to really understand virtue and to understand what kinds of human beings we should be. And so classical education. George Washington, of course, helped to found a school in Alexandria, Virginia, the Alexandria Academy. And it encouraged a classical education, and he was very intent that this school be open to everyone and there be free tuition for those who couldn't afford it. Orphans of people who died in the Revolutionary War, it should be open to them. It should be open to African Americans. It should be open to women. He was way ahead of his time in terms of saying, look, we need to found schools that will educate all levels of society, all people. That will prepare them for citizenship in this republic.
I think every single revolutionary thought about this issue of education, and many of them sat down and wrote up plans for essentially a three-tiered system that's not all that different from what we have today. Jefferson's most famous, where he talked about both boys and girls would go to what we call elementary schools. And then he said, we'll rake the rubbish, that's the term he used, and pull out of this elementary school those bright boys only who would go on to grammar school, which would be essentially high school, but teaching Latin in preparation for university. And then the best, and all of this was to be publicly supported, that is with tax money, and then the best of the grammar school graduates would be sent on to the university, which would also be publicly supported for the elite leadership that would result.
And this was Jefferson's bill for the more general diffusion of knowledge in Virginia, where he lived at Monticello.
Right. And of course, others, Benjamin Rush, others drew up. In fact, I think per capita were probably more publications on education in this period than at any time in our history. I mean, it's a real spate of publications. Everybody's talking about education.
Benjamin Franklin, who founded the University of Pennsylvania and the Library Company of Philadelphia, wrote that education of youth is the surest foundation of happiness. Charles Haynes.
He famously said, only a virtuous people are capable of freedom. But last quoted is the second part of that same sentence where he said, as nations become corrupt and vicious, they have more need of masters.
Meaning tyrants.
That's right. And he believed that unless we provided education so that people would learn civic virtue and would practice civic virtue, they would be subject to authoritarian and tyrannical impulses.
For many of America's founders, moral development and the practice of courtesy were almost a preoccupation. As a schoolboy, George Washington would write out in elegant script the rules of civility. The revolutionaries envisioned a society based on moral principles. Joel Spring is an historian of education at the City University of New York.
You're sitting there after the revolution, you're scratching your head, trying to figure out how things are going to work. You're worried about the mobs out there. You've just had a revolutionary war where you've had these people come out of the forest to shoot their guns at the British, etc. How are you going to control them? Well, you start preaching civility and morality and we'll all get along, and you try to paint that picture and you try to educate people that way.
Personal and social virtues were an explicit topic taught in early American schools.
In the minds of most educators, and let's say in the early 19th century, these were Protestant virtues. And in fact, when Horace Mann organized the common school in the 1830s, he was concerned about religious conflict over the common school. So what Horace Mann advocated was that what we would do is we would take the basic virtues taught in the King James Version of the Bible, and without any religious trappings, those would be the virtues taught in the school, and those would be the virtues necessary to sustain the Republic.
And could you specify some of those virtues?
Responsibility, reciprocation. If you do something good for me, I should try and do something good for you. Charity. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. The idea that the rich were blessed by God and the poor had a chance to be rich and therefore virtuous. Hard work, diligence. Idle hands are the devil's tool. So these were the kind of virtues that you had a responsibility to your fellow human beings. Of course, we had slavery, and we won't go into that, and Native Americans, which means that many white people weren't responsible at all. But anyway, to other free people, you were responsible and within the golden rule, and that at the same time, you worked hard to improve the community itself. And we have to remember that until the Bible and prayer decisions of the 1960s, that most public schools in this country opened with a school prayer and a reading from the Bible. When I went to school in Florida, that's how school began, and those were virtues that were to be instilled.
The The United States, founded on Jefferson's declaration that all men are created equal, has continuously struggled to interpret that principle from generation to generation. At the country's beginning, only property-owning white males were allowed to vote. Full citizen participation has advanced only by fits and starts since the Revolution. Historian Annette Gordon Reed.
Hamilton believed that the reason for the condition of African Americans during that time period is because they were not educated and that they had not been given opportunities. There wasn't a, what you would call an abolitionist movement in the way we think of it towards the antebellum period.
But you're saying that Alexander Hamilton understood that the black population was disadvantaged because of education?
Yes. I mean, that's one of the things that he said, that the problem is a lack of experience, lack of education, that it's not natural. Now, he was countering at this point some of the things that Jefferson had said in notes in the state of Virginia about black inferiority. He was saying that he ventured it as a suspicion that blacks were intellectually inferior to whites. Hamilton, sort of, and then private correspondence at some point says, well, you know, it really is about the lack of opportunities that people have. How do you say that people are inferior if you've never given them a shot at being educated?
I think the story of American history is the ongoing struggle to live up to the principles and ideals in our Constitution and our founding documents.
Charles Haynes of the First Amendment Center in Washington.
They didn't live up to them. We still have not lived up to them. So the struggle throughout history is to call the American people to go back to those ideals and say, now what can we do to advance freedom and justice for all? How can we come closer to those ideals? So no, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, and others, they weren't perfect and they didn't live up to their own ideals.
True of our politicians today.
Well,
imperfect.
True, that's right. But you know, I always remember what David Walker, the great abolitionist, African-American abolitionist, said of Jefferson. He said, you know, and this is while Jefferson was still alive, the end of his life, he said, you know, Thomas Jefferson, he's the greatest philosopher alive. He says, but I don't know why he says what he says about black people. But he said, but here's the issue. How can we out Jefferson Jefferson on the racial question? And so I think that's always the question for every generation. How can we out Madison Madison and out Jefferson Jefferson? So the ideals, the Jeffersonian ideals, the Madisonian ideals, which are so deeply important to who we are as a people, it's always a struggle to live up to what we say we believe.
Listening to Humankind, I'm David Freudberg. Studio recording by Antonio Oliard. Editorial assistance from Thomas Royal and Kathy Graham. Webmaster Brian K. Johnson. Special thanks to Laura Carlo, Guy Byrne, and Tony Buck. Our program is produced by Human Media in association with WGBH Boston. Program development provided by Chart Media.
To purchase a CD copy of this program, please call 1-800-5-LISTEN. That's 1-800-5-LISTEN. Or visit our website, where you can also obtain an audio download of this and our other programs and can hear selected episodes free. You can access free written materials related to this program as well. Our web address is humanmedia.org. Again, if you'd like to purchase a CD copy of Humankind by phone, please call 1-800-5-LISTEN, and our web address is humanmedia.org.
This segment, part one of An Informed Republic, is Humankind program number 151.
The executive producer is David Freudberg. This is Humankind.
Coming up in a minute in the second half of Humankind, we visit the United States Supreme Court for a special conversation with retired Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, the first woman ever to serve on the High Court. She's concerned that so few Americans understand the basics of how their country operates, and she warns of dire consequences. Justice Sandra Day O'Connor and more on An Informed Republic, when Humankind continues in a moment.
WILL programs are made possible by English Hedgerow, full-service florist located at University and Lincoln Avenue, Urbana. English Hedgerow can coordinate your next party with fresh flowers, innovative designs, and a different accent.
Humankind is produced in association with WGBH Boston and supported by the Humankind Program Fund.
The government structure that the framers designed was rather new at the time. It was an experiment. And the development of three branches of government, each with some power over the other two, was new. And it obviously was dependent, as a republican form of government, the framers called it, it depended on the participation of its citizens to make it work.
Justice Sandra Day O'Connor on the current threat to our democracy of low citizen awareness. You're listening to a Humankind special. I'm David Freudberg. Across the street from the Capitol in Washington, the stately U.S. Supreme Court building rises four stories above First Street Northeast. Its public facade, constructed with white marble from Vermont, bears the motto Equal Justice Under Law, supported in the front by eight imposing columns.
Oh, yay, oh, yay, oh, yay. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of the United States, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Since the court's first hearing in 1792, nearly two centuries would pass before Sandra Day O'Connor was sworn in 1981 as the first woman to serve as a justice. She retired in 2006 at age 75. On a recent trip to Washington, I paid my first visit to the majestic Supreme Court building, perhaps the closest our secular government gets to sacred space. I had never before conversed with a justice.
Ma'am, what is the proper way to address you, please?
Justice O'Connor, if you want to be correct about it all.
I do.
You can call me most anything.
A Stanford University law graduate, now with silver hair and wearing a black and white floral jacket, Justice O'Connor sat with me at the judge's dining table in a brown-paneled room on the third floor. She reflected on the nation that was intended by America's 18th century founders.
It wasn't going to be on autopilot. It required direct citizen participation. And I think there were many at the time who thought that it was an experiment that couldn't succeed, that self-rule was very unlikely in a society as diverse as what was happening in this country, with people coming from various places in the world, and as it turned out, a very geographically large country to be in. So there were lots of doubts about how it would work. It was clear, I think, very early in the United States that it was necessary to have some form of getting our citizens informed about the structure of government and how citizens could participate and be part of it. That was essential.
Since stepping down from the Supreme Court, Justice O'Connor has championed more active participation in our democracy by American citizens. It starts, she says, with basic awareness of how the country operates.
There is a shocking lack of knowledge of our system of government today, lower probably than it has ever been. I look at the statistics provided by the Annenberg Foundation, which takes polls periodically about what people know and what they think. Today, barely one-third of Americans can even name the three branches of government, much less say what they do. Barely a third. In order to become a new citizen of our country, it's required that the applicants pass a test on our form of government and answer all kinds of questions. This is a test that at least two-thirds of Americans today can't pass, including students in high school.
How paradoxical in this age of unlimited information.
Yes. I mean, we have information out there in theory on the web and in the libraries, but it doesn't mean it's in the head where it counts.
And you say it may be lower than ever. Why have we reached that nadir?
I'm not sure. I wish I knew the answer. But certainly you can say that part of it is due to the fact that half our states no longer make the teaching of civics and government a requirement for high school graduation. They don't even make it a requirement. I went to a public high school in El Paso, Texas, and we had some kind of government or civics classes every year that I was there. Of course, most of them dealt with Texas, but be that as it may, it was some form of government or civics. And today, half the states don't require it. Now, that is amazing to me when you look back and see that we started public schools in the first place in order to teach young people how to be good citizens. And why we would have dropped it, I'm not sure. And we certainly have. Now, America's high school graduates were tested along with those of up to 20 other so-called Western nations. And you know, of course, that our country came in at the bottom or near the bottom in math and science. We were pathetic. And in comparison to all other nations, the president and Congress thought that was something we better take a look at and do something about. And that's why a program for, they call it No Child Left Behind, was developed, which provided public funding to public schools for high school education, not in civics and government, in math and science to make up for this deficit. And what the program did was give public money, federal funding, to public schools based on test scores of the schools in math and science. If they got some decent test scores or showed improvement, then public money would be funneled into the school. Well, the unintended consequence, in part, of that program was that schools didn't get public money for civics and government or history, and so many of them stopped teaching it because they didn't have this financial incentive.
So do you see the reduction of civics education as directly a consequence of the No Child Left Behind wave of standardized testing?
Indirectly, it's up to the school board what they're going to fund and teach. But it's clear that because there is no financial benefit under this No Child Left Behind law to schools based on civics and history, that they're motivated to focus on the areas where they get money for doing well. You see, it's just a natural consequence of it.
What are the dangers of low civic awareness in the country?
Well, the risk is that citizens who don't understand their role and don't understand the system of government are not going to be very supportive of it. They're not going to pursue avenues and goals that would help the country govern itself better. That won't be their interest at all. And I think to have a successful Republican form of government, as the framers would have called it, or democratic form of government, as we would call it today, it requires citizen participation. And you know perfectly well that knowledge isn't handed down in the gene pool. We have to teach it to every succeeding generation, and we are not doing it.
And if we continue not to do it, what do we lose?
Well, we lose the participation of citizens. They're inclined not to vote. They don't care who represents them. They don't think it makes any difference. They don't participate. And we just, we come closer to failing as a nation.
How do you see the pervasiveness of public apathy and so many people disengaged from public discussion of issues that genuinely affect their lives?
Well, clearly, lack of discussion and participation is a natural consequence of this business of not understanding how our government works and not realizing how critical it is that we have informed citizens being active in making the decisions that affect all of us.
Justice Sandra Day O'Connor decided recently to engage young people in the civic education she feels many schools teach inadequately. At the project's website, iCivics.org, colorful cartoon characters let a visitor play games like Executive Command, where kids can vote online for president and click buttons like one titled Inaugurate Me.
It has been amazingly well received by young people. And our website is aimed at middle school students, 6th, 7th, 8th graders. That's a perfect age to teach on this subject because it's the years when those youngsters first have the intelligence and capacity to understand these concepts. Their brains have evolved to that stage and they're eager to learn. They love going to school. They like everything. They're not bored teenagers interested in other things. They are at that age interested in learning. And it's just a great audience. What we did was develop a program to teach civics that incorporated the use of games that the young people could play. And that would be fun to play. I mean, you have to capture their interest and their willingness to play games, to win points and to do well, to make them play it. And we've succeeded in that. And there are games that are designed to teach them something and be fun to play. And what we've heard repeatedly from the young people who are exposed to it is, wow, it's cool. We like it. It's fun. And if you've got that, you have their full engagement and attention.
And they can write to you through that website.
Well, they can. And it's questions they can ask, and over time I can try to answer, not all of them, but some of them. And they ask all kinds of questions. They ask about why we started it and is it constitutional for their schools to require school uniforms? What I like to eat and what games I play. I mean, they ask every kind of thing you'd expect a youngster to ask.
We're talking with former Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor on this Humankind Special, An Informed Republic. I'm David Freudberg. To learn more about this segment and to find a link to Justice O'Connor's project for young people, please visit our website, humanmedia.org.
We live in a time when the calmer and perhaps more reflective pace of reading newspapers and books has been replaced to some extent by the instantaneous communications of electronic media, including the internet, 24-hour cable news, and emotionally charged talk radio. What are your thoughts on how this new media landscape affects democracy and our ability to be well-informed?
Well, of course, we've had newspapers with us since our country was formed. There was some kind of print distribution of newspapers. And we later got, of course, radio and television. Now, every sector of the news media industry is losing audiences, except maybe not cable news, maybe not all digital news, but everything else is declining in users. And people are finding other ways to get information. I'm not quite sure what it is. But it seems to me that to see those statistics, it convinces me even more that we have to have civics education in the schools so that everybody can understand and somehow evaluate the information they get. They have to learn what kind of information sources are helpful. They need to learn that.
Are you concerned that the heavy concentration of media ownership by a small number of very powerful companies skews public understanding of important issues?
It certainly can. If you get all your news from one source or two sources, I think you're not getting a balanced presentation.
Not necessarily fair and balanced?
Not necessarily. And I think it's a source of genuine concern. I would think for those in public broadcasting, it ought to be a very serious concern. And that's why people in the public broadcasting areas are having to work very hard to maintain a large user audience.
So what skills should citizens develop in order to absorb a broader range of information so that we can better perform our duties as the citizen?
It all comes down to education, all of it. We have to teach our citizens about government, politics, international affairs, what's happening in the world that affects them, and how the country world works, how the rest of the world works, and what we're doing about it. What are the problems, and what are the proposed solutions, and what should we do? And you need to teach people how to think.
Critical thinking skills?
Critical thinking skills are very important. If you can't analyze what you read and weigh and balance proposed solutions, you aren't going to reach good solutions. So we have to teach that.
In this current period, we have a shockingly large percentage of the American public who will tell pollsters they believe Barack Obama was not born in the United States.
Yes, I've heard some of that.
We have people who believe that the health care reform was going to institute a series of death panels. And a lot of people accepted this misinformation, and it has had a profound effect on our national discourse and on our national policymaking.
Well, you have put your finger on precisely the kinds of misinformation that can emerge when you don't have all our systems working to provide information that's accurate to the public and to have a public that has the capacity to understand and analyze it. That's exactly what happens. You're seeing the evidence of it and describing it.
As a lover of newspapers, are you worried at the decline in newspapers?
I am, because that's what I like, and I don't want to go read it on my computer screen. I may have to, but I don't want to.
No Kindle for you?
No. Well, no, I have a Kindle. I love books on the Kindle.
Okay.
That isn't how I get my news. I want to hold a newspaper. But on a Kindle, I love putting books because I travel all the time, and I can put several books on my little tiny Kindle and travel with it, and it works.
I think you're kind of cutting edge.
No. Definitely not.
Thank you very much. We've been talking with Justice Sandra Day O'Connor here at the United States Supreme Court.
The days when major cities had several daily print newspapers dominating coverage of current events have succumbed to a perfect storm of economic, cultural, and technological changes. Many distinguished papers have shrunken, migrated online, or gone out of business, like Denver's Pulitzer Prize-winning Rocky Mountain News in 2009.
Throughout the night shift, printers seemed drawn to the presses to watch the final run of a paper some of them worked on for decades. Downstairs, security guards grabbed extra copies as souvenirs. This was the beginning.
At stake in the decline of newspapers is more than thousands of laid-off workers and a city's sentimental attachment to its local paper. Studies have shown that newscasts on radio and TV, news websites, and bloggers heavily base their coverage on expensive reporting originally performed by newspapers. With the evisceration of traditional papers, trustworthy source material becomes less available. But as pointed out by Robert McChesney, professor of communication at the University of Illinois, the downward trend of newspapers preceded the Internet explosion.
For the last three or four decades, we've seen newspaper and news media ownership heavily consolidated in the United States into fewer and fewer hands. And the people who own the companies that run these newsrooms have taken, you know, short-term profits. They've basically done what's, from an investor's perspective, eminently rational. They've cut back on newsrooms. They've cut back on coverage. They've increased the inexpensive stuff. They've basically derailed the franchise so that by the time the Internet came along and had an effect, America's newsrooms were already in deep trouble. They'd already alienated a generation of young readers who really saw no reason to pick up their paper.
To compete with millions of no-cost websites, newspapers started to give away their valuable content online free of charge, a policy many papers have found financially unsustainable. Advertising revenues, historically about two-thirds of newspaper income, have dropped sharply. Classified ads, long a mainstay, can now be placed free on popular websites. So Bob McChesney, co-author of The Death and Life of American Journalism, says that for the sake of democracy, the entire model of financing public access to information must be reconfigured.
We have to really understand journalism as a public good, not as a private good. That journalism, like Jefferson and Madison understood it, even though they didn't have the concept of public good then, is not something that you just turn over to the market, and if you get it and get lucky, then you can have a democracy, and if the market doesn't give you journalism, you're just out of luck and you have to find a king. Rather, journalism should be regarded like national defense or public education or national parks or basic academic research, something the market cannot provide in sufficient quality or quantity, but that's desperately required by a free society. And then it's a public policy decision about whether you're going to have national defense or public education or journalism. And that's really how we need to think about it, because if we simply keep into sort of this brain set that the market will simply come up with the answer eventually through some magical technology or advertising sort of deciding to go back to journalism, I think the evidence is already in, and we put it in the book. It's not going to happen. There's not an iota of evidence. That doesn't mean we won't have some commercial journalism that's going to survive. There's no doubt some will. But we've lost, you know, a significant percentage of our working journalists and editors in the last 20 years already. And that's going to continue.
And further thinning of journalism's ranks will deal a body blow to our system of checks and balances. Robert McChesney.
People in power and people who want to be in power, both in the public and private sector, and especially as the two intersect, have to be held accountable. They have to be watched rigorously. There has to be a way to monitor what people in power and who want to be in power are doing, so people know what's going on.
In this age of mounting crises, from oil spills to Wall Street meltdowns, climate chaos to terrorism, the vigilant practice of journalism plays an essential role in safeguarding our democratic society.
It needs to have a sort of an early warning mechanism. A great news media will anticipate problems before they become so large they're unsolvable or the cost of solving them is, you know, catastrophically large. Good journalism in a free society will make problems that might fester, will lead to violence or a huge cost, will alert people to them so they can be nipped in the bud in a humane, peaceful, democratic, rational manner. That's the goal. And then the last aspect of great journalism that a free people needs is you've got to have some sort of way that over time liars are exposed. You know, some people are going to lie and get away with it some of the time, as Abe Lincoln said. But you've got to have a way that if someone's lying, they can't do so with impunity forever. And I think what we're seeing right now in our news media system, the way it is devolving, is that liars basically go unchecked now. And I think that in itself is something that is extraordinarily frightening.
The primary news source for most Americans is the glitzy newscasts produced by commercial television. Professor Bob McChesney, author of 12 books on mass media, says that TV news reportage, especially by local stations, is often superficial and unsatisfying.
Look at it. I mean, there's very little actual journalism on it. It's primarily inexpensive stuff. It's either spoon-feeding us what someone in city or county government says, or it's covering a train wreck or a bus accident or something sensational, something inexpensive, cheap, easy to cover that doesn't require a lot of journalism.
For younger Americans, the internet now rivals television and has already supplanted newspapers as their primary news source. But is the blogosphere, lacking even the standards of mainstream journalism, an adequate substitute for the full-time effort and investigative skill of trained journalists?
We can't have a journalism that's done by volunteers, whether it's people who have trust funds and have time to kill so they're really rich, or they're employed and doing it in their free time. Our goal should be to have competing newsrooms of paid journalists who are accountable, who are in competition. Monopoly is the enemy of freedom and of a free press, no matter whether it's public or private. So those are sort of the ways you get there, in our view. And this is the important thing, is where do we get the resources to pay for it, since advertising is not going to put it up. And frankly, the corporate community, the Wall Street community, is more or less jumped ship on journalism. It doesn't really have any necessary interest in it. And fair enough, nor should they. They're out to make money. That's their job.
Bob McChesney has documented the long history of publicly funded journalism in America. Until the 1860s, federal printing jobs were contracted out mostly to newspapers, in part to subsidize them. Public libraries have long offered free access to a wealth of information. And in 1967, Congress established the Corporation for Public Broadcasting to support public TV and radio stations and their program suppliers.
Journalism in and of itself, the news, has never been commercially viable. And this is something economists recognize. I mean, it depended on advertising throughout the 20th century to provide the vast majority of revenues to be economically viable. But if you took advertising away, it wouldn't exist as a commercially viable enterprise. And in the 19th century, it took massive government subsidies to make it viable. It's a public good. I mean, the evidence screams at you. If we're going to solve it, we have to recognize that. If we think the market's going to magically solve it, it simply won't happen. And if we don't have journalism, we're going to have news no matter what. We will have 24/7 cable channels. We will have websites. We'll even have some sad excuses for newspapers. And we'll have commercial radio and TV news. But we will have very little journalism. What we think we're aiming toward, unless we intervene aggressively, is going to be just a nutritionless, journalism-free news, which will really be much more like propaganda and public relations and spin, and frankly will be the death knell of self-government in the United States.
Listening to Humankind, I'm David Freudberg. Studio recording by Antonio Oliard. Editorial assistance from Thomas Royal and Kathy Graham. Webmaster Brian K. Johnson. Special thanks to Georgetown University Law Center, Colorado Public Radio, Jonathan Cohen, Terry Pickerel, John Vosey, and Tony Buck. Our program is produced by Human Media in association with WGBH Boston. Program development provided by Chart Media.
To purchase a CD copy of this program, please call 1-800-5-LISTEN. That's 1-800-5-LISTEN. Or visit our website, where you can also obtain an audio download of this and our other programs and can hear selected episodes free. You can access free written materials related to this program as well. Our web address is humanmedia.org. Again, if you'd like to purchase a CD copy of Humankind by phone, please call 1-800-5-LISTEN, and our web address is humanmedia.org.
This segment, part two of An Informed Republic, is Humankind program number 152.
The executive producer is David Freudberg. This is Humankind.
On the next Fresh Air, the Carolina Chocolate Drops bring their fiddles, banjos, bones, and jugs to play music in the black string band tradition. Join us.
Today at 1 p.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Sunshine marks our Monday, mostly sunny and a high of 90 today. South winds 10 to 15 miles an hour, gusts to around 20. For tonight, partly cloudy and a low of 68. South winds at 5 to 10 miles an hour. Tomorrow will be partly sunny with Tuesday's high 91 again. South winds at 10 to 15. For tomorrow night, mostly cloudy and a low of 72. Light south winds, partly sunny and 88 for Wednesday. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3, Urbana.